Here we go.
Neutron, proton, mass defect, lyrical oxidation, your irrelevant mass spectrograph, your electron volt, atomic energy erupting as I get all open on betatrons, gamma rays, thermal cracking, cyclotron, any and every mic you're on, transuranium, if y'all was uranium, molecule spontaneous combustion, pow. Law of definite proportion gain, ink weight, I'm every element around.
Welcome to Spark Science, sharing stories of human curiosity. This is our first ever episode. My name is Regina Barber DeGraff. I teach physics and astronomy at Western Washington University. And here next to me is my co-host and also sixth grade classmate, Jordan Baker. And I'm going to let him introduce himself a little bit.
Hello, my name is Jordan Baker. I do improv at the Upfront Theater in Bellingham, Washington.
Awesome. And this is our first ever guest on Spark Science. And she is Dr. Melissa Rice, who is a science team member of the NASA Curiosity Rover mission. And she's also an assistant professor of planetary science at Western Washington University with me. And why don't you introduce yourself and tell us a little bit about yourself, about your position, let's say, at Western.
Sure. I have a joint position between the geology department and the physics and astronomy department. My expertise is in Mars, which involves rocks that are not on the Earth, so I'm kind of in this dead space between geology and astronomy. But I teach classes in both departments, and I still work on the NASA Mars rover missions, the Curiosity mission, which you mentioned, as well as the Opportunity mission, which has been chugging along on Mars for more than 11 years now.
So what's the difference between the Curiosity mission and the Opportunity mission?
About 1,500 pounds.
Okay.
So the Opportunity mission was...
Not a lot.
No, they're totally different. If you look at them, they're like apples and oranges. They're both six-wheeled robots driving around the surface of Mars. But Opportunity went to Mars, landed in 2004 with a twin rover, Spirit.
Okay.
They were cute little rovers. People tell me they look like Wally.
Okay.
They had two little eyes and solar panels that made them look like they had wings. But Curiosity was the next generation rover. Big beefy rover, weighs 2,000 pounds, and it's all white. It doesn't have solar panels. It carries its own nuclear power source, so it looks like it has a big butt sticking out the back of it.
Right. And he looks like he has a monocle, right? Like the big Curiosity.
He has a
camera that kind
looks
of
looks like it has a big cyclops eye
right
on top of it.
Yes.
I think it's interesting that you used he.
Oh, yes. It's because I'm sexist. But
well, it's the biggest,
well,
beefiest rover out there.
She
so
mentioned the big butt, so
right,
I would assume female.
Oh God.
Oh, now who's sexist?
Yeah. We're both sexist. I remember seeing a picture of Curiosity and having the head kind of is boxy, and he has this long neck, or it has a long neck. It does not have gender, you're right. But it had like kind of a picture of a cartoonish version, and it had like a monocle kind of in a, I don't know.
Yeah, exactly. So Curiosity, it still has two eyes,
okay,
but they're under the big boxy thing.
Okay.
And the box has a single large camera in it. It's actually a telescope.
It's a telescope,
and it's also a laser that shoots holes in rocks.
Right.
Yes.
Yeah.
That's what I'm talking about. That's the Mars stuff I want to hear about.
Right. So there's a robot on Mars that has a laser shooting out of its, near its eyeball.
Shooting out of its big Cyclops eyeball at the top of its head.
All right. So
what does it eat?
With
the laser.
Well, I think it's solar powered, so it eats sun, right?
No, this one.
Oh, it's not solar
nuclear powered.
You're right.
It eats radioactive decay particles.
Right.
No, but I have a friend who calls that laser the FLOIF, which stands for freaking laser on its freaking head.
Nice. Sort of Dr. Evil sort
of
thing.
Like
lasers
an allusion to that.
On the sharks, right?
Yeah.
Or on the dolphins. It's the sharks. I don't
deserves
remember.
Every animal should have a warm meal.
You're right. So your students at Western, because not a lot of people know this, but there's a lot of like undergraduate research that happens at Western Washington University, WW, I'll just say that. So some of them can actually look at data that came directly from Curiosity, right? Like straight up like recent stuff. So what do your students do? I'm just guessing right now.
Yeah, no, so my students can do that, but it's not because they're special because they work with me. It's because everybody can look at the data immediately after it comes down from Curiosity.
Really? Oh, that's right. You were telling me about
most of the pictures, all of the pictures from Curiosity's engineering cameras go online immediately after they get down here to Earth. So I don't get to see them any sooner than you do. They're just go directly up to the NASA JPL website, and anyone can go online and see them immediately.
Wow.
So, you know, I like to think when I come into work and I look at the newest images from the rover that maybe I am the first person to ever see this new vista of Mars. But these images have been online sometimes for hours, and it's probably someone in Australia who's got up way before I did who gets to be that real first person to see something new on Mars.
But you do get to tell the rover where to go, right?
That I do get to do. Or I get to provide input into where the rover's going to go.
Is it a democracy? Is there a vote on where it goes?
There is a democracy, yeah. So we spend the first 2 hours of our day making a plan for what the rover's going to do tomorrow. And there are usually a couple dozen scientists on the phone line giving input and trying to make these decisions about what we're going to do. And if there's ever headbutting, then we bring it to a vote.
Okay. So I want to take a second, though. I want to go back, though. I want to go back to, like, when you were an undergrad, or even before that, like, what made you really interested in, like, Marsology, right? So it's not geology, right? It's, like, Marsology.
Yeah, we call it Martian geology.
Okay.
But no, I'm with you, though, that it really should be Marsology. And there are all of these Earth-centric terms that we use that are...
Like my gender-centric term earlier.
Yeah, well, you know, it's... That tickled me because I'm so used to hearing people call these rovers she. Out of the tradition of ships are called she.
Oh, really?
And ships are always female.
Right,
and these
right. And
robots
cars.
Are really ships of exploration.
Of course.
That
so we refer to them as she.
You were right. You were right. Jordan was right. Of course. He'll always be right every episode.
Okay, good to set that precedent.
Yeah. Now. Yeah. I will be wrong and he will be right. So yeah, so I was probably one of the first people that called it a he. That you've heard?
That I've heard.
Wow. Well, that makes me feel better.
Well, you were thinking Monopoly.
I was thinking Monopoly. I was thinking of Mr. Pennybags, right?
Yep.
Which wouldn't be rich if you had Pennybags, right? Yeah. Anyway, let's get back. Let's get back to your childhood.
Yes, back to childhood.
Yes. So when were you interested in planetary science? When did that start?
Not really until college.
Oh, really? Okay. So yeah, I was right with undergrad.
Yeah, yeah. I was interested in science beforehand, but I went to college not really knowing what I would do. I didn't declare a major in astronomy and physics until late in my junior year.
Oh, wow, that's really late.
So, yeah, I was kind of pushing it. And then even then, I didn't really know much at all about Mars until I was a senior in college. And I heard a talk at MIT by one of the then NASA administrators, someone who worked at NASA headquarters, who was giving an overview talk of new results from the Mars Global Surveyor mission.
Okay.
And that mission, MGS, was taking some of the best pictures ever taken of Mars, let alone any other planetary surface. And there were pictures that he showed of ancient stream beds and gullies and all of this evidence that I had not been aware of, that Mars was once a place with water all over it. Running water, standing bodies of water, and water that might have been there for long periods of time. And so that was the first time I had really heard anyone talk about Mars as a realistic place where life might have emerged.
Right.
Not a science fiction war of the worlds, aliens, little green men kind of a thing.
But Mars Attacks, the movie.
Yeah, not so much that, but real possibilities that
so
there could have been
life. So what interested you was basically the history of Mars?
Like, yeah, exactly.
Like how it was?
And I think that's what interests most people who study Mars. Mars as it is today, it's like the worst place on Earth times 100. You know, it's 100 times drier than the driest spot on this planet. It is extremely cold. Temperatures on average are minus 70 to 100. So it's a pretty
Fahrenheit
nasty place.
Celsius.
Fahrenheit.
Fahrenheit. Okay. You know who you're talking to. Got it.
That's right, Dr. Barbara DeGraff.
Well, that's right. You're listening to Spark Science, sharing stories of human curiosity. If you're just joining us, my name is Regina Barber DeGraff, here with my co-host Jordan Baker and our special guest, Melissa Rice, who is from Mars.
So Mars today, it's this cold, dry, barren, desert place. It's a pretty awful place. But it's Mars as it was billions of years ago in its past that is what drives me and a lot of my colleagues to go and explore it. Because 3 billion years ago and before, Mars might have been a much more Earth-like place, a place with weather, a place with clouds and rain and snow and lakes and rivers and something that would seem a lot more familiar to us.
So is that why you're going to study it? Maybe you think, like, this may be our future. We're going to be minus 70 to 100 degrees Fahrenheit, negative, like, cold. Like, are we trying to get information on where we could be going, or?
Yeah, so comparing the Earth to Mars and also to Venus is understanding three examples of what can possibly happen to a planet. So the Earth is kind of the Goldilocks planet. It's not too hot, it's not too cold, it's just right for life right now. Mars might have been more like Earth, but it's gone in one extreme direction. It's become extremely cold, extremely dry, extremely dead. And Venus has gone in completely the opposite direction. Venus might very well have been a more Earth-like place early on too, but now it has a runaway greenhouse effect. It's extremely hot. The surface is hot enough to melt lead. And the atmosphere is incredibly thick. And it's just too hot for liquid water or any forms of life to survive. So could the Earth go in one direction or another? I don't know. They're both pretty extreme examples. But I think we would be irresponsible not to try and figure out how a planet can go in one direction or the other. Because we're starting to see hints of change on our own planet.
Right. So what you are looking at with your data, are you looking at basically the life that was on the planet, or is there still chance of any sort of reservoirs of water? Because I know that, like, NASA's phrase is, like, follow the water, right? That's how we're going to find life on other planets, follow the water. So is there still some, any amounts of water still on Mars that may have some information, or is that not happening?
Yeah, so we know there are small amounts of water vapor in the atmosphere, and on certain cold nights, that water vapor can condense onto the ground, and we've even seen frost form on the surface. But we don't think that there's really enough life to sustain anything living on the surface.
Okay.
Even the hardiest little microbes probably have a very, very small chance of being able to survive on the surface. But if you go deeper and deeper beneath the surface, it's going to get warmer and warmer. And eventually, there may be a place where there are reservoirs of liquid water underneath the surface of Mars. And those are the places where, if there is any life hiding out on Mars today, it's probably deep, deep down where the last remnants of liquid water are.
Right. So I mean, I was trying to look on the internet about, like, this place called NASA Watch, and it basically kind of pools together a whole bunch of NASA press releases. And I just looked for the phrase life on Mars specifically, and, like, over 1,000 like hits came up. So, like, what I'm trying to ask is, like, how has the history changed? Like, when NASA was looking for life on Mars, has it eventually gotten to the part where it just thinks, I'm just going to look at the history? Or, like you're saying, is it still holding out for something actually on Mars?
Yeah, we are not really holding out hope for existing life on Mars. Yeah. I mean, I'm not going to close any doors here.
Right.
Anything's possible. But what we're more actively looking for are signs that life had ever been on Mars.
Right.
So when the exciting discoveries that I think might be possible in my lifetime are finding fossil evidence for microbial life preserved in ancient rocks on Mars, or finding other biosignatures, which are basically fingerprints that something living, some type of biology, had been present on Mars at some point in the past. Personally, I'm not holding out any hope that we're going to find E.T. on Mars today, but we might find the dead remnants of his brethren.
Okay. Dead but, E.T. Okay.
Yeah, but, you know, not 60 years ago, it was pretty much accepted that Mars was a place that likely had life. And that Mars was a place that probably still had some kind of vegetation.
Right.
Maybe not little green men, but at least lichens and mosses. And the early astronomers who were looking at Mars with their newfangled telescopes were seeing what they thought were seasonal changes on the surface due to vegetation blooming and coming in and out of season. And it turned out that those seasonal changes that they saw were just dust blowing around on the dry surface of Mars.
Oh, wow.
But in the 1950s, it wasn't crazy to think that there was, had been ancient, even intelligent life on Mars, and that today there was still some kind of living vegetation. It really wasn't until NASA sent its first missions to orbit around Mars in the early 1960s that we saw that there were no intelligent beings who had built canals on Mars, that the surface was largely a dead, cratered landscape and not the kind of ancient civilization preserved on the surface that some early astronomers had thought. And that's also when we saw that there really was nothing at all living in the surface, no evidence for vegetation, even the most primitive kind.
You're listening to Spark Science, sharing stories of human curiosity. If you're just joining us, my name is Jordan Baker. I'm here with Regina Barbara DeGraff, and we are talking with Melissa Rice.
Sixty, mm-hmm. No, in our early 30s. I remember the rover mission in the 90s. Do you remember that, Jordan?
Nope.
Okay. Well, when Jordan and I were in high school, I think it was in 1997 when the first little rover went on.
Yeah, the Sojourner rover.
So I was obsessed with that, and I remember thinking it looked exactly like Arizona. Like Mars looks like Arizona.
Yeah.
But I'm really interested in like how these missions are progressing. Like you said, like the two that you're associated with are just very different. But what is it going to be like in the future? Like, what are future missions going to look like?
So the next mission,
yeah,
is going to look exactly the same.
Okay.
All right.
Yeah. We love ruts.
Redundancy.
Yeah. Redundancy is good sometimes.
It's called Mission Heritage.
Is it really? Wow.
Yeah.
Okay.
So, but it's going to be a completely different rover. It's just going to look the same.
Okay.
So it's going to use the same big boxy white body as Curiosity. It's going to have the same kind of power source, that same big butt. It's going to have the same tall neck with its cyclops eye at the top.
Laser eye. Okay.
But instead of having all of these very sophisticated scientific instruments inside the body of the rover, this rover is going to have a different set of instruments, and it's going to have the capability to drill into rocks, extract little core samples, and store those core samples of rocks in some kind of protective tube or vial, and store those on the surface of Mars so that the next mission will land next to it, pick up those rocks, and eventually bring them back to Earth.
So we are actually thinking about making missions that, like, launch off of Mars.
We are.
Oh.
Yeah, and
I did
so
not know this.
The next big leaps in our understanding of Mars are going to happen from bringing rocks back here on
Earth.
And it really has to, because there's only so much technology we can send to Mars. We really, in order to keep pace with technology, in order to do the most detailed investigations and do our due diligence, we have to do that in laboratories here on the Earth. And so the next big step is to bring rocks back. And the next rover that's going in 2020, it's not going to have the capability to launch anything off of Mars, but it's going to select the best rock samples we possibly can, get them stored up, get them in a nice little pile so that eventually, the next mission, we'll be able to bring some fuel with it so that it can land, pick up those rock samples, and then launch off of Mars.
So right now they're all staying on Mars. It's like a used car lot. Like they're
yeah, it's like a rover graveyard on yeah. Mars.
Awesome.
Well, they're not all dead though, right?
Because they're not.
It's
they're
not a graveyard. It's like an elderly home or something.
That's true. Yeah. It's like a graveyard convalescent home for rovers. But
people
you know,
have good
I think,
lives there.
Right, leaking oil.
It could be like an what? It's like a community. It's not you know necessarily assisted living. But anyway,
they
so
all have
at least their bodies aren't decomposing up there.
Yeah,
you know?
They're having
it's
a good time.
Pretty dry, sterile environment. So we might be able to go up there and give them a jump start someday.
That's true. Just like Wally, you were just alluding to Wally.
Yeah.
So this mission that's going to come and launch off, is that going to be a manned mission?
Probably not.
Or female.
Oh, yeah. Sexism.
A human spaceflight mission.
Yeah, human. Yeah. Probably not, is what you're saying.
Probably not.
Okay.
I think it's going to be exorbitantly more expensive to send humans on that mission to collect these rocks and bring them back. And I think it's going to be really important that we can demonstrate at least once that we can bring something we send to Mars back. Before that, something is a live human being.
Right. That is very true.
Yeah, so I think it's going to be two parts. You know, it's going to be a big part science, getting those rocks back to Earth so that we can do the kinds of detailed investigations we need to do in order to really advance our understanding of Mars. And it's also going to be a technology demonstration to show that we can land precisely at a location on Mars, launch away from Mars, and travel back to Earth safely.
Couldn't the little Curiosity or whatever it's called, couldn't it just hook a bunch of rocks onto like a bottle rocket and then just shoot it out into the atmosphere? Do you guys not have like a bottle rocket technology?
No, I don't think it'd give enough thrust. I don't know.
Yeah,
think,
we
Melissa?
Probably need a little more power than a bottle rocket.
All right.
Just a little bit.
Just like hoverboards.
It's an idea. You can give it to them.
Okay, I'll pass that along.
Yeah, thank you.
Some bottle rockets, yes. Aside from Mars, I know Mars is your love, but like, is there any other planetary, you know, be it a moon or a planet that we are planning to go to take similar data?
Well, Mars has the advantage of being pretty close to the Earth.
Right.
So it only takes 7 to 9 months to travel, to send our rovers from the Earth to Mars. Anywhere else we want to go in the solar system that is equally as interesting from a perspective of past or present life on another world, for those questions, we need to go to the outer solar system, the moons of Saturn, like Enceladus, the moons of Jupiter, like Europa. Those are the other great candidates for places that might be habitable worlds, places with liquid water that might, even today, have some kind of life within them. But to get there, that's a matter of years to decades.
So how long
to months?
How long would it take to get to Europa?
There are different concepts, but on the order of a decade.
Oh, wow.
So, and it's not just the Earth to Europa distance. It's in order to save fuel. It makes a lot of sense to slingshot your spacecraft around the planets. So it makes sense to get what we call a gravity assist, which is basically flying around another planet like the Earth or Mars in order to get a boost of gravity, kind of some free propulsion, slingshotting the spacecraft into the outer solar system. But in order to do that, in order to get that free gravitational assist, that free slingshot, we have to do orbits around other bodies, and that's what takes a long time.
You're listening to Spark Science, sharing stories of human curiosity. If you're just joining us, my name is Regina Barber DeGraff, and I'm here with my co-host, Jordan Baker, and our wonderful guest, the Martian Melissa Rice.
It's a long time to spend on a spaceship. I mean, if there was some guy on there for a decade.
Yeah. Well, that's why we're not talking about sending humans that far yet. But there are, you know, there are advances happening in spacecraft propulsion. Ion propulsion, for example, is a way to get things far out there in the solar system directly. So it could happen within our lifetime, but it's still going to be a long journey.
What is your opinion on manned missions to Mars?
I'll tell you my opinion of human missions
right.
to Mars.
Sorry. Again. Yeah. I'm terrible.
No,
human
my
mission
opinion,
to Mars.
My
yes.
opinion is... It should happen. It should have happened 40 years ago. And I hope to see it happen in my lifetime. I think it really has to happen in order to give NASA's human spaceflight program direction and a real goal. I think that's something that NASA is struggling with right now. What is the purpose of our humans in space? What's the big picture here? What's the end goal? And I think Mars is really the logical next place to go, the next big goal. And we just need to get a commitment financially and philosophically to get out there.
What's your opinion on manned missions? Human missions.
Human missions.
Jordan.
I am not quite sure. You said that we should have done it already. Is there something that is like holding us back from doing it other than the financial backing?
It's really just finances.
It's not like a secret, like they had the technology the whole time.
Right, or we found the super intelligent apes there.
Right. Yeah.
No, it's just political will in order to give NASA the money that it requires. I mean, this is tens of billions of dollars we're talking about over multiple decades to plan and execute this mission to Mars. And I think we had good momentum in our space exploration in the 1960s with the Apollo program, and it would have logically happened more most easily, and it could have come directly out of the Apollo program. And it was always NASA's intention to go from to the moon and then beyond, and Mars was always the logical next step. And ever since the 1960s, NASA has been saying we will get humans to Mars in 20 years. And that was the plan in the 60s, following on behind the Apollo missions to the moon. And now here we are in the year 2015, and we are still saying we'll get humans to Mars in 20 years. NASA's goal is the mid-2030s for a human mission to Mars.
Is this like a race, like the space race was between the Soviets and us? Are they sort of that little competition again with like Russia or something?
Yeah, is there anybody else?
Well, there is no competition to get there? And the competition kind of fizzled out. And I think that's why we never have gotten to Mars, is because we got to the moon because there was that intense political motivation with the space race to show our technological dominance, to get there first. And once that competition, that political driver, once the bottom fell out from under that, you know, these are some of the negative side effects of world peace, is that we no longer have this.
If
strong...
we just didn't have peace, we'd have already gone to Mars. But there is also the other issue. I mean, there's so many articles about radiation and how that's a major drawback. Are you saying that that's not as big as it is played out to be?
In terms of something
of
that would
human
make
missions.
It difficult to get humans
yeah.
to Mars. Yeah, no, radiation, it is going to be a big deal. A lot of things are going to be a big deal, but there's nothing aside from the money that is going to be insurmountable or that is preventing us from going. So the radiation humans are going to experience a lot of it on that interplanetary journey. And they're going to significantly increase their risk of cancer. And it's going to significantly increase their risk of dying in a rocket explosion. And so I think that, you know, we're going to have to accept a lot of those risks. But I think that our astronauts and I think the public is going to be willing to accept those risks in order to do something so bold.
So we were talking about Austin Powers earlier. Is there some sort of a cryogenic human freezing that we can do so they don't get as much radiation? Or is that sort of just a mythical Hollywood?
Yeah, so there is no cryogenic hibernation that we can put people in. I know, that's just kind of the easy way out that every Hollywood movie about space travel takes is just freeze them and they go to sleep for 20 years.
Right.
Yeah, even if they were frozen, they would still experience that radiation. You need, like, something to shield them from that radiation.
They would have to be frozen in lead.
Right, right. Like Han Solo, you know.
Oh.
Yeah, actually.
That's why they did that.
Hmm. But so if they were just sleeping, like if you just had a spaceship and everyone was sleeping, I mean, everyone would still get radiation.
Or to just lay some lead blankets over them, like the X-ray?
Right, like in the dentist?
Yes, yes. Just get them dentist.
Right.
Blanket bibs.
Yes. But yeah, it's funny that you asked that, Jordan, because there was an astronaut that was speaking at Western recently, and she's asked that question over and over and over again. And she's like, no, it doesn't work. But there's also bone loss when you're in space. She was talking about, hopefully we can get her on the show.
Like osteoporosis?
Yeah.
Like grandma?
Yeah. And they have to work out how many hours? I don't know if you went to the, Melissa, if you went to the talk.
No, I didn't make that talk.
Yeah, she said you had to exercise like, I don't know, 2 hours a day, 4 hours a day. We have to just get her on and fact check this. But,
definitely.
But yeah, no, it's so there's many, many things. But I think, Melissa, you're right. I mean, if we're, you know, space travel is dangerous. There were rockets that blew up. All this stuff could happen. But astronauts are willing to take that risk. And there are humans out there that are willing to take that risk. There are humans that are signing up now that say they want to die on Mars, you know, so
yeah.
And never come back. Never do that, you know, launching off of Mars. They're okay if that never happens.
Right. There will be a never-ending line of people willing to sign up for that one-way trip,
mm-hmm.
knowing that they never will return. And I think that's a fundamental part of who we are as a species. We are... We are people who explore, right? We our ancestors have gotten into boats and sailed to the ends of the ocean, not knowing if the ends of the earth were there. That's what we do. That's what has separated us from all of our predecessors and the Neanderthals. We are the species that goes out there just because we can.
Because we're curious?
Yeah.
Curious. Because we are curious.
We have curiosity.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Like curiosity. Oh, my gosh.
You're welcome.
Thank you, Jordan. So I'm going to end this with a question that I hate being asked of me. So I'm going to ask you this question.
I'll thank you in advance.
Yeah. It. Yeah. I teach astronomy, and I am constantly being asked if I like certain astronomy-related movies, like Interstellar. Still haven't seen it. Have you seen it, Jordan?
No.
Excellent.
Never even heard of it.
Really? So I haven't seen Interstellar, but I want to know, do you have a favorite Mars-related movie? Because I know I do.
Oh.
Yeah, I do.
Can I guess Mars Attacks?
It is Mars Attacks. Okay. You mean the movie I alluded to earlier or mentioned earlier? What about you, Jordan, before we hear Melissa's favorite Mars-related movie?
It probably have to be Mars Attack. But
yeah.
I don't really know any other
Are there other watchable Mars movies?
Oh, my God. Maybe there isn't.
Maybe there's not. I mean, was it Red Planet with Val Kilmer?
Oh, yes, there is Red Planet.
So I have a certain love for that movie just because the way that they land the astronauts on Mars in that movie is exactly how they landed the Spirit and Opportunity rovers.
Oh, really?
Which was in no way meant to be a way to get human beings onto the surface of Mars. So this is what they did. They dropped them down in a with a parachute to lower them down.
Val Kilmer,
yeah. Okay. So he's being lowered down in a parachute. Mm-hmm. But then, before he hits the ground, a bunch of airbags inflate around his spacecraft. The parachute detaches, and Val Kilmer, inside of all these airbags, hits the ground and bounces and bounces and bounces and rolls and rolls and rolls until he comes to a stop.
Is it a coincidence that the rover did this and Val Kilmer did it, or what?
I think not.
Really?
So I think this is one of the first Mars movies to come after Spirit and Opportunity landed on Mars. They used this airbag system. It sounded crazy, but it worked. Big success, got a lot of attention in the media. And then this movie came along and said, oh, well, that's how NASA lands things on Mars now. Let's use that. But what an awful way to get yourself down to the surface of Mars.
Well,
and bouncing and bouncing and bouncing and rolling and rolling and rolling.
Right. Well, you'd be very sick.
You would be.
Yes. But it's good because most movies and shows like Star Trek, they kind of inspire space exploration and inspire space innovation. And I think it's kind of cool that it was the other way around in this movie, you're saying Red Planet.
Yeah.
Yeah,
that's
very interesting.
And I think WALL-E was definitely inspired by the design of the Spirit and Opportunity rovers. You know, everyone tells me when I give talks about the rovers and I show the pictures, they say, oh, it looks just like WALL-E. And I want to say, no, WALL-E looks just like them.
Oh, wow. Plot twist.
Yeah.
So there is going to be a Mars movie coming out.
Oh.
Have you heard of this book, The Martian?
It's from Ray Bradbury, right? Or is
that
a short
Martian
story?
The Martian Chronicles.
Yeah, okay.
So
then
there's a
no.
New York Times best-selling kind of adventure book out right now called The Martian. And it's actually really entertaining, and the Mars science is not half bad. And I've heard they're going to make a movie out of that starring Matt Damon. So this has potential. I'm going to get my hopes up. This has potential to be an actually good Mars movie.
Well, I'm going to look out for that.
Fingers crossed.
And maybe finally watch Interstellar. Maybe. But I wanna thank you, Melissa, for coming to talk to us and
yes, thank you.
Yeah, and being our first guest ever. Yeah, I'm so excited. Yeah,
well, thank you for allowing me to share my curiosity.
So much curiosity.
All right.
Lead, gold, tin, iron, platinum, zinc. When I rap, you think iodine, nitrate, activate. Red uranium, the only difference is I transmit sound. Balance with some balance, then you add a little talent in. Careful with those ingredients. They can explode and blow up if you drop them and they hit the ground.